You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation.
Welcome back to another episode of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati of 154 Advisors, and I'm here on behalf of the Best Innovation Group, where we like to do cool things with technology for the financial services industry, credit unions, banks, fintech companies. My particular focus is on payments, but we're going to run a little bit further afield of that today for the broader scope of the notion of financial literacy and inclusion. And as I mentioned to our producer, Laura, I feel a bit like I've staged a bloodless coup over the Big Cast, just given how many of these episodes I've been doing recently. That's because it's heavy conference season. And one of the things that I particularly enjoy doing is going out, hearing the latest in terms of thought leadership in the space, and then tracking down people who make a particularly strong impression on me and gathering interviews from the field. And that's what we're doing again this week. In fact, all I had to do was take public transit down to downtown Atlanta, where I live, for this one. The Operation Hope Forum took place last week. And I visited there and got a series of good interviews, and we'll talk a little bit about that in just one second. I will mention right now that there is new content here on the Big Cast every Tuesday. Please do check us out there, either at the website, big-fintech.com, or please do subscribe to the podcast wherever you prefer to get your podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, if iTunes still exists, as you've probably heard this week. That's being remodeled and probably a separate podcast app that Apple will be putting out in the near future. And those of you who miss John Best's voice, never fear. We'll both be back next week. And by the time, if you're listening to this soon after it was released, we're probably in Minneapolis while you're listening at the AXFI conference, which is co-sponsored by the Best Innovation Group. And John and I will be there on site with a series of interviews, and we'll be jointly hosting that one. So stay tuned. That one should be posting next week. But anyway, for this week, back to Operation Hope. This is one of my favorite. This is the second year that I've attended, and I find this particularly an inspirational conference. The focus is on financial inclusion and empowerment. That is the mission of Operation Hope, that works in underserved financial communities. You know, the word diverse is used a lot, and it's often kind of a code word. And this conference is diverse in many ways. It is racially diverse. I'd say the audience is probably roughly 50% African American, but I'm using that word in a much broader sense than that, in that it's not a typical financial conference. Most of the speakers are not specifically related to the financial services industry. That may be a bit of an overstatement, but a lot of the speakers are much more far-flung, as you'll hear from some of the people we were speaking to there. Incredibly high-powered as well. We had Robert Crandall, the longtime CEO of American Airlines, gave the opening session presentation. Ed Bastian, current CEO of Delta Airlines. The CEO of UPS was there. Ambassador Andrew Young, former mayor of Atlanta. Incredibly deep roster of people. Jack Dorsey from Twitter and Square, a little bit more directly related, at least on the Square side, to the financial services industry. We'll come back to that one too. And one of the things that I particularly like about this conference is John Hope Bryant, who founded Operation Hope, really goes out of his way to keep it as nonpartisan as possible. As he points out, financial inclusion is not a partisan issue. He's worked across the aisle with presidents from both parties over the course of time in the history of Operation Hope, and even before that. Just really interesting stuff, inspirational messages, and a really good exchange of ideas, which I'm going to get back to again, because it's fascinating to me how some ideas, depending on the venue in which they're delivered and to the audience into which they're received, can really be heard very differently. And that one really struck me as part of this conference as well. But anyway, I want to start off with one of the sessions that I found the most interesting, a woman by the name of Marielle Beasley. She's the co-founder of the Common Sense Lab at Duke University. You may be familiar with an author named Dan Ariely. His best-known book is Predictably Irrational. Marielle co-runs this center, which focuses on behavioral science and figuring out the way people really behave, as opposed to classic economic theory, which assumes that people are rational and behave in their own best interest. Obviously, we would like to think we are, but things don't always turn out that way. Her session was called Hacking Human Behavior, and the basic message is that humans are just not really programmed to behave in their best interests in many cases. So trying to get past that, understanding what really does, you know, move the meter as far as working on things like financial stability, savings for long-term and retirement, and things like that. And that's really what they're focused on at the Common Sense Lab and the Center for Advanced Hindsight, a name that I love, which is kind of the umbrella organization that also works in other areas, including healthcare around this. So got a chance to catch up with Marielle after her presentation. Let's have a listen. Glenn Cervotti here at the Hope Global Forum with Marielle Beasley, the co-founder of the Common Sense Lab from Duke University. And I am tempted to re-enroll after seeing your presentation because I really enjoyed that.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So behavioral science is the focus of what you're looking at. And you're also, I love this name, the Center for Advanced Hindsight, going back and looking at people's behavior. And I guess the way you defined it, which I thought really kind of summed it up well, is the gap between people's intentions and their actions.
Yeah. So essentially what we find over and over again is that people can have the best of intentions of doing something that does not actually mean that they will do it. So we really focus on both, why does this gap exist, right? You would assume that if somebody wanted to do something, they could just do it, unless there are sort of major physical barriers. So behavioral science really looks at this gap between, like, why does this gap exist? And then how do we help close this gap based on changes in the environment?
And your group is focused not only on financial well-being, as well as, I understand, healthcare. Obviously, we're focused on the financial side here, but that's the two pieces.
Yeah. So within the Center for Advanced Hindsight, we've got teams that work on financial behavior. We've got teams that work on health. And then we have some teams that work actually on the intersection of the two.
Obviously, a big intersection these days.
Exactly. And it's actually alarming how closely those things are related.
So one of the things, I guess, kind of a bad news, good news thing, an alarming statement that just getting through the detail that we went through today, financial literacy, and no shortage of attempts to do that. And at the end of the day, you're kind of saying your research shows that it's not really moving the meter.
Yeah. So this is research that comes from Daniel Fernandez and John Lynch and out of UC Boulder that really was a meta-analysis of all the research that had been done on.
So taking everybody who's looked at this and aggregating
exactly,
it.
Exactly. And then trying to get sort of what is the average effect size. And really what they find is, this 0.1% of the variance in financial behavior is attributed to this financial education.
In other words, virtually none.
Yeah, exactly. And even lower, right? Even lower for low SES households.
SES?
Social economic status.
Got it.
So low income households, it's even less than 0.1%. And, you know, there is a correlation between if you have higher financial literacy, you do tend to also have better financial behaviors. The problem is that we haven't figured out a way to actually teach financial literacy in a way that it translates to financial behavior. So that's one of the challenges that hasn't been cracked, and yet that's still the solution everybody goes towards and spends a lot of money on trying to solve. But
so your focus is to really figure out how we can turn that, make the actual action. I mean, and one of the things you pointed out is that, you know, classical economic theory focuses on the notion that people are rational.
Right.
And that's not the way people are behaving, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there are some decisions that we make where we do actually sit down and think about costs and benefits, and we do try to actually calculate probabilities, and we do spend the time on that. That's actually just a very, very, very small subset of our decisions. Most of our decisions are sort of in the moment. They're based on these, you know, other things that are happening around us. They're based on rules of thumb that we might know. They're based on these really automatic small shortcuts.
Now, just so people know, we're not at a cocktail party. People are cleaning up this room after we went through. It's actually a college setting, the way we're sitting here in kind of a lecture hall. So can you talk a bit about, you showed the application Digit that you used as one of your ways to do a social experiment to see how people would change their behavior around same. You also pointed out, you know, I think the power of defaults, I think, is really a great place to kind of maybe start on this.
I like to describe it as people are a little bit like water. We tend to flow downhill.
Okay.
And so if you want to change the direction that water is flowing, you have to either put rocks in the way to get them to divert, which is essentially kind of changing the default path, or you have to sort of dig new paths, right? So a default really is about how do you change the downward motion? The kind of classic example here is the 401k, changing it from an opt-in where you had to do something in order to enroll and start saving in a workplace 401k. And now there's been a large shift in the US where many, many, many employers now offer it as an opt-out, which means that you have to do something to not participate. And actually, the human behavior in both cases is the same. People don't do anything. But what happens?
doing something is
you
now
have different
becomes
outcomes now.
The quote-unquote good thing.
Exactly, exactly. And the problem is there's not really good defaults for short-term emergency savings.
And you mentioned also for the gig economy, people who don't have solid, you know, every biweekly or monthly or whatever type of pay cycles.
Exactly. So even when we think about these automation of savings, of short-term savings, almost every automation savings program out there, particularly from major financial institutions, almost all of them are you have to pick a specific day and you have to pick a specific amount for that money to get transferred. And if your money is, sometimes it comes a lot more, sometimes it comes a lot less, it just gets tough to be able to sign up for an automatic savings process. And so it really relies on this manual piece. So you're really losing all of the benefit of trying to make something easy.
And you mentioned before, I mean, the thing that really freezes people into a lack of action is make it seem important and make it seem complicated. And then they just freeze.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So we are really sensitive to feeling regret.
We as
human beings. Right, exactly. So we hate the concept of regretting a decision. And so, you know, we often say that the best way to get somebody to not do something is to tell them this is a really important decision. It's really complex. It's going to have huge implications on your life. So it's really important. Here's a whole bunch of information and materials to help you figure it out. Let me know what you want to do. It's a great way to get somebody to procrastinate and not do it because they never feel like they have enough information to make that decision. And so a default is actually a way where you say, okay, you can always come back and change this, but we're going to at least get you started without having to do any effort because it's taking that complexity out of what's the right thing to do.
That makes sense. Yeah, you pointed out that we're just not, and the great comparison you made also is around exercise or diet or something like that. You know, we're not programmed to do, you know, good behavior and long-term behavior. And that's why we have challenges with things like savings or even budgeting for a monthly basis. You pointed out that people, if you look at a monthly food budget, that's not the way you shop. You're shopping multiple times every month, and that creates a problem, which is another application that you were looking at as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when we have people create budgets, we're often having them create them on a monthly cycle. And that's just more out of old habit of the way that we've thought about budgeting in the U.S. historically. And so when people sort of think about their budget and they say, well, this is how much I'm going to spend a month on groceries, nobody shops once a month on groceries. Right. And so we worked with Propel.
Propel being another app.
Yes, it's a fintech app that is linked with people's EBT cards.
As a SNAP benefit.
Exactly, exactly. So it's a way that they can kind of check their balance, they can see where they're spending, et cetera. And so we worked with them to essentially, we just changed the overlay screen. You know, we didn't change the way SNAP benefits were dispersed, which are once a month.
Right.
So we didn't change any of that. But what we did is we just overlaid digitally a screen that had just a recommended weekly budget. So we just took their total benefit, divided it by four, and that was displayed. And it wasn't dynamic. There wasn't any sort of complicated programming or it didn't change based on how much people had actually spent. It was just their full benefit divided by four. And what we found is that very simple digital change stretched benefits by two additional days.
Because I think you'd mentioned originally when people just saw the entire balance hit their account at the beginning of the month, the 30-day monthly balance pretty much was drawn down within about nine, I think you said?
Yeah, so they spend 80% of their benefits in the first 9 days.
Yeah.
And then they sort of try to stretch it beyond that. But and then there's other sort of research, not from our center, but elsewhere, that really sees that, you know, there's all these other sort of negative health
You and mentioned also, I was amazed, that you said that days away from the SNAP distribution actually had a correlation with test scores of the students.
Correct.
Amazing.
Yeah. So people are actually running out of food.
Wow.
And so our hypothesis is part of it, not all of it, but part of it is probably driven by some overspending in the beginning of the month because people are anchoring on their full monthly benefit. And so they're probably overspending in those early trips to the grocery store. And so by kind of getting people to anchor on this smaller amount, it can sort of get people to spend less, particularly in those early trips, to help stretch it a little bit further. And indeed, we did find that we were able to stretch them by 2 additional days.
2 days is 2 days. That helps.
Yeah, which is great.
These fintechs, do you have any type of stake in them, or they're just a really logical place for you to really put these field experiments out there into the market?
Yeah, so we partner with all kinds of financial institutions. So any organization, company that intersects with people's financial life and are trying to do good. That's a big, we're very mission driven and really focused on financial health and wellness. But if they are basically working and have goals that are aligned with us around trying to increase short-term savings, increase long-term savings, decrease debt, manage cash flow, if they're focused on any of those things, we have an application process. And so we actually have these organizations apply to work with us for 6 months to a year.
And then you're a great resource for them.
Exactly.
In terms of being able to see how this stuff actually plays out. And if it works, obviously that's a feather in their cap
too. Yeah, exactly. And so it works out really well. So we've had over 50 partnerships in the last 3 years, and we've done over, I think we're at over 70 actually projects now.
Wow.
Of experiments that we've run in the field. And sort of we're learning what works, but we're also learning what doesn't work.
Which is also just as important.
Incredibly helpful.
So if people want to find out more, what's the best way to get in touch?
Well, you can visit our website. It's commonsenselab.org.
And that's common sense, C-E-N-T-S, correct?
Yes, that is correct. We like puns in our office. So common sense with C-E-N-T-S .org. You can also find us at the Advanced Hindsight .org as well.
That goes to the same site?
And there's a button on it to go specifically just to the Common Sense team.
Your subset. Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
But we've got our annual reports up there, so you can kind of read about all of our different studies. We always write up both what works and what doesn't work.
Perfect.
So it's a great resource for folks who are interested. And we've got them sorted by, you know, decreasing expenses, increasing savings to help make it really actionable for organizations who are really looking to help move the needle on financial health and well-being.
Wonderful. Marielle Beasley from the Common Sense Lab. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
One of the things that really struck me from her presentation too, Marielle mentioned that it's estimated that 58% of all Americans will be contract workers in some fashion by the year 2027. And obviously, based on some of the stuff you just heard us talking about, that creates an added challenge. The lack of a predictable biweekly paycheck really changes the picture, as well as the potentially the inability, unless the rules are changed, about how people save for retirement through 401ks and whatnot. So as she pointed out, this obliterates a lot of our current savings paradigms and something that we definitely have to be looking at. So I'll be following along closely. We'll post a link there to the Common Sense Lab, and I'm definitely going to be keeping track of what they've got going on over there. So one of the things I mentioned before we started that last session is the nonpartisan nature of the Operation Hope Global Forum. And one of I jotted down real early in the sessions that it really struck me how it's amazing that a message that is delivered, you know, both the speaker, but even more so the venue in which it's delivered, can really affect the way it is received. And this struck me when I was hearing Robert Crandall speak, the former CEO of American Airlines. He had a reputation as a fierce, fierce cost cutter and a very pro-business individual. His message was almost entirely around income inequality and the challenges that that poses and the concerns that he has about that, which, you know, again, was not necessarily where I expected to hear him coming down on this. But one of the points that I thought was very interesting, despite that reputation he had as a cost cutter, he was always an opponent of airline deregulation. Most people will tell you that airline deregulation obviously has kept prices down dramatically and many more people are flying than used to. We have more service issues than we have in the past. His point, and he drew this, and he did not say this directly, but when I did a little bit more reading up on his history, one of his concerns about it is he believes that airline deregulation probably exacerbated income inequality to some extent. Because as he points out, despite the fact that more people are flying, they're flocking more to the major cities. And many of the secondary cities that used to have air service no longer have it, makes them less economically viable, causes people to cluster more in the cities, which may or may not have contributed to some of the issues we have in rural America right now. I just find it to be an interesting, different approach to thinking about things and a message coming from a business leader that I'm not sure would have been received quite the same way if it was given to, let's say, the Chamber of Commerce and then reported on in the media. Kelly King of BB&T, obviously in the process also of merging now with SunTrust Bank. He's the CEO, Kelly King is. He made a comment that, again, I just thought was fascinating, talking about education and the concerns about making sure that we have an educated workforce, both for the purposes of addressing income inequality and the workforce needs of the next generation. And I wrote this down as a direct quote of what he said. Government cannot solve the education problem alone. The business community must get involved. Okay, I agree with that. It got applause from this audience. Again, if the American Enterprise Institute or somebody like that at one of their conferences said that, I think would probably the reception and the perception of what was being said there would have probably been somewhat different. Which I find fascinating, because I think if we can strip the politics and the preconceived notions out of some of the things that are being said on both sides of the aisle, I think we can probably see that there's, you know, a little bit more common ground than a lot of people would like to think. And with regard to the business community getting involved in education, again, Kelly King did not make a reference to this, but the Georgia FinTech Academy, and we've done an episode on that in the past, has got some really interesting public-private partnerships in the works on that front. We'll post a link back to my interview with Art Recesso, the Chief Innovation Officer of the University System of Georgia, on that front. And another person at the conference, again, that gave a message that I think could be received very differently, Joseph Otting, who's the head of the OCC. And according to John Hope Bryant, I didn't realize this, he mentioned, is the first banker to ever sit, a banker by profession, as opposed to a career bureaucrat, regulator, whatever you want to call them, the first banker to actually sit in that head of the OCC chair. As you probably know, there are movements afoot to alter the way we approach the Community Reinvestment Act, CRA. It's pretty much been in place in the same form since the 1970s when it was first put in place. And he is arguing, Joseph Otting is, that the changes that they're looking to do to to those regulations, rather than gutting them, which I think is the fear of a lot of people, he believes will increase investment in underserved communities by 20 to 40%. Yeah, I think there's probably some people who might debate that, but I think it's worth hearing. And when someone like John Hope Bryant, who is so focused on financial inclusion, speaks highly of Joseph Otting and is willing to listen to these things, I think we all ought to take a closer listen and see exactly how those things may play out. More on Operation Hope. Anita Ward is the president. We did a whole episode with her about 18 months back, and we can post a link to that one as well. But I caught up with Anita, a very, very busy woman, as you can imagine with a conference like this, both busy in terms of her schedule, also busy trying to find a quiet corner in a very crowded hotel to talk. So you may hear a bit more background noise on this one, too. But we caught up the morning of the second day of the session, talked a bit about the overall initiatives and how they're going with Hope overall, particularly the focus on credit scores and trying to, through financial literacy and education and empowerment, improve the credit scores of people who have had challenges along those lines. Let's have a listen.
Glenn Servati at day two of Hope Global Forum, and as is usually the case around here, struggling to find a quiet corner to actually have a conversation with Anita Ward, president of Operation Hope. Anita, thanks so much for carving out the time. I know you're going to be on stage very shortly at the breakfast. Again, more amazing growth. I hear over 5,000 people over the course of 3 days
here. I was going to say, it's kind of hard to find a quiet corner where there's 5,000 people.
Exactly. 5,000 attendees over the course of 3 days. Yesterday, a full slate of sessions. Today, we've got Jack Dorsey coming in, and you're going in for Women in Entrepreneurship shortly. One of the things we were just discussing, for the first time this year, there were breakout tracks, as well as just the general plenary sessions. One on FinTech, which I was involved in, and then also Women in Entrepreneurship.
Yeah, there's actually three of them.
Oh.
So we decided that there were a couple of emerging topics. One around FinTech, and you know my background's technology.
Yes.
So it's
close and
dear to my heart. But I also think it's just redefining banking. And in so many ways, also redefining nonprofits and redefining charitable giving. And how do we ignore FinTech in a world where, you know, CRA reform is underway? Technologies eliminating branches, some are expanding, some are contracting, there's still a community focus. So we thought it was really important to highlight FinTech, both as a traditional and non-traditional banks sit in the room.
Can you remind people again, your background is in bank
sure,
technology,
it is.
Right?
Yes, it is. So for many years, I was with Chase and ran Emergent Technologies. There were five CIOs. I was one of them. And so for me, it's really important to focus on how do you leverage technology as a tool. And in fact, at Operation Hope, we implemented a digital platform recently so that we could scale our business. So we've now moved, I think the last time we talked, we had fewer than 100.
Yes, definitely.
Much fewer than 100 locations.
I remember it was later on, and you hit that triple digit number, which was great.
Yes, and now we are at about 138 locations. But interestingly, in addition to that, we support about 2,500 communities, and now we're rolling out a digital platform that will just scale our business and allow us to help so many more people.
So you don't need necessarily the brick and mortar. And again, the phrase, the branding is Hope Inside.
It's called Hope Inside because we sit inside of somebody else's organization, whether it's a bank branch or a community center or an employer. So Hope Inside is where we provide financial well-being counseling to people who are struggling. And we focus on improving credit scores. And I think you probably saw that we just released a report by Accenture. And what we found was that when Accenture looked at our work, we're actually moving credit scores by 35 points in 5 months.
That's impressive.
Which is better, exponentially better than anybody else. We don't really have competitors in the nonprofit space, but other people who do financial well-being are typically averaging around 11 points a year. And you know your credit score will fluctuate.
Yeah.
11 points in a year. So,
easily, yeah.
So the impact that we're generating, the impact that we're generating is really quite impressive overall. But forget about the impressive part. I mean, it's helping people now have access to capital and changing lives.
And I know the goal is, I know John has stated, John Hope Bryan, the 700 FICO score communities.
Yeah,
that's kind of the benchmark you're looking for, right?
Yeah. Our average client comes in with about a 570. And so we're moving them over the course of about 12 to 18 months by 120. Sometimes, I think I saw yesterday that we had moved somebody 300 points.
Wow.
So it depends upon, think about it like your personal, you know, well-being coach. And they'll come in and assess your body and tell you what you need to eat. That's basically what we do. We assess your financial health. And then we create a series of interventions for you to move you to a 700 credit score, to improve your savings, decrease your debt, and you know, find a pathway to prosperity.
Is the 700 still more of an aspiration, or are you hitting that target?
Oh, we're hitting it.
You are? Wow.
Yes,
okay.
About 20%.
I thought of that as much more still kind of a hope.
No, for about 20% of our clients, and think about where their baseline is, for about 20% of our clients, we're moving them to 700 credit scores in the course of a year.
Wow. Okay. And obviously, the goal is the community of the credit score.
The goal is an aggregated community uplift.
But obviously, it's a little, and you said we're up to what, 130?
We have 138 locations.
And as you said,
about 2,500 communities.
Digital locations, exactly.
Well, no, digital is even beyond that. So now our new model, the coaches will actually support more than one location.
Okay.
So in our SunTrust branches, for example, where they have a commitment to 200, we have 24 locations, but those 24 locations, each one of them supports about 20 of the SunTrust branches.
Okay.
So the coaches are really making inroads into each community.
So if people want to find out more, obviously OperationHope.org.
OperationHope.org.
And there's recent reports. Is there anything specific that
Well, here's something I think is super exciting for me as a woman and as a technologist.
Oh, that's right. We were going to talk to this as a whole track. Yeah.
We introduced a Women's Entrepreneurship Accelerator. So the fastest growing segment of small business are African-American women. And we thought it would be really important to run in parallel a couple of tracks this year.
Yes.
So one was an accelerator where women come in with their business plans or their idea. And it was sponsored by MetaBank and MasterCard, too. But they come in and they share their business plans with a group of peers. There were, ended up being 200 in the room, but don't tell the fire marshal. They sit at a table. They get a panel of experts. The experts talk about everything from your passion and purpose to marketing and technology and pricing. And then they work their plans. And so they have a peer group. They have experts at every table.
Oh, that's great.
And at the end of the day, 17 women pitched their businesses. And they pitched them for startup capital. And there were three women selected. And they each received $2,500 in startup capital to advance their business. And so now we had 500 women in a line yesterday who hadn't registered, pre-registered.
Yeah.
So I couldn't get them in. But now we're thinking, this is really important. Maybe we should do this even as a standalone. We also introduced the fintech track that you were on. And as I said, I think that's really important. That might be just my personal bias, but I think, you know, technology is the game changer anyway. And then we had one that was next gen. Did you hear about that
one? Oh, yes, the young entrepreneurs,
so
exactly.
So
I saw some of their booths.
I'm no longer a next gen. But we thought, you know, let's not get tied up in our own heads. It's lovely to have incredible people on the stage. But who are we all looking forward to? We're all looking forward to Jack Dorsey.
Yeah.
And so what's happening from the perspective of youth and how do they address the topics? And so if we're talking about pathways to prosperity or education or credit scores, does it still resonate the same way? Because the next generation is going to carry this forward. So it was a completely separate track. and young people were in there. And it started off with the actress Kat Graham. And Kat is amazing, and she challenged them to find their own pathways. So
I did actually yesterday. They had some of the young entrepreneurs a boost, and I stopped by with a biodegradable poop spray.
Isn't
for
that
dogs.
Awesome?
Yeah, that was, I picked that up, yeah.
Well, and think about that. So now those young, in fact, those two young women have an IP, so they've got their patent filed.
Oh, they do? Wow, this. I didn't know that. Wow.
And then the other ones, did you see the ones who made the edible wrap?
Yes, I did see that.
So these aren't kids coming in with, you know, cupcakes or airbrushed T-shirts. These are people. The girl who won is from Detroit, and she actually invented an app for shopping and inventory management.
Wow.
So the world has shifted, and we think that's important. So every one of those had some technology components. So you go back to the technology track, and we think that technology could go a long way to eradicating poverty if we're smart.
Well, now it's all tying together. I actually saw the lineup of people waiting to get into the Women's Entrepreneurship Breakfast yesterday when I was downstairs. And then I actually stepped in late. I was interviewing Marielle Beasley from Common Sense Lab during lunch. I stepped in early. I saw two of those pitches. I didn't realize that was a women-focused thing because the two women – I saw two pitches that happened to both be women. I didn't realize that was a female-centric
Yes, and it
program.
Was all day. So their commitment was from 8 in the morning. I think I judged the last one at 7 o'clock.
Oh, wow.
So this was, you know, 12 hours of intense
That's why I couldn't find
activity.
You yesterday.
You could not find me. I was in and out running around.
Finally had to, you know, just run into you the hallway this morning. So, well, great. So the information on those two programs also available on the website,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
OperationHope.org.
Yes, and we'll do more.
Wonderful. Anita, thanks so much for taking
the
time.
It's good to have you here.
Thanks again to Anita for carving out some time to talk to us there. Again, it was a great conference. 5,000 people, I understand, was the overall registration. And another point that was made by a couple of people along the way, I found this very interesting too. Martin Luther King, not long before he was assassinated, had really begun to pivot from pure civil rights into financial rights and working more directly across the underserved populations as opposed to specifically among the racial minority groups. One of the things that was pointed out is we met at the Hyatt Regency in downtown Atlanta. This was not known to me, but apparently, according to what I was told there, that was the site of Martin Luther King's last staff meeting with the SCLC. When other hotels, it was a brand new hotel coming up in downtown Atlanta. Other hotels had turned his group away. This was where they did have one of, if not their very last, one of their last meetings, just not many weeks before Dr. King was assassinated, a bit after that. Finally, one more interview. One of the other interesting things that took place this year at Operation Hope is, you know, like I said before, an incredibly active agenda with a lot of star power. I found it fascinating that there was a panel discussion with Raphael Bostic, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Paul Wolfowitz, who is, again, more identified with the Republican right-wing side of the party, of the political conversation. He's involved with the American Enterprise Institute. But he did mention very clearly that he has worked with 7 different presidential administrations across both parties within the organizations. And then rounding out that panel, Ambassador and former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young. And a great exchange of ideas. And one of the things, again, that I found just so refreshing that I wish would happen more often, it was clear the mutual respect that Paul Wolfowitz and Andrew Young had for each other, as well as a very solid working relationship, both in terms of the way they addressed each other and even the body language, you know, touching each other's shoulders and whatnot as they were speaking. And it just created a very, very valuable exchange of ideas. And obviously with Dr. Bostic as well, really trying to keep things under some semblance of a structure with Andrew Young. And Paul Wolfowitz kind of going in different political directions as well. I found it to be a very, very valuable session. But anyway, what I was starting to say there, we have so much content and so much that fintech itself, financial technology, can do in addressing some of these inclusion challenges, that for the first time, Operation Hope did actually break out a separate track of fintech content. I was fortunate enough to present and be part of a panel on that track on how fintech can play into inclusion. With Dr. Art Recesso, as I mentioned before, from the University System of Georgia, and the former president of Clark Atlanta University, and the head of the Money Network at First Data. And that panel was moderated by Ida Rademacher of the Aspen Institute. She leads their financial security program. And in the context of our conversations, I learned a bit more about what the Aspen Institute has going on in this space. So we found a few minutes afterwards to have a conversation. So have a listen.
Glenn Cervata here, wrapping up day one at the Hope Global Forum with Ida Rademacher, who is the head of the financial security program at the Aspen Institute. And she also was the moderator of a panel that the two of us participated on this afternoon about fintech's role in fostering financial inclusion. And thanks for taking the time, Ida. I found out about some interesting things you've got going on at the Aspen Institute that I thought would be great to catch up on.
My pleasure.
So you mentioned before, with more and more fintechs in the space, we're developing a wealth of data. The trick is to figure out a way to harness it to really get the takeaways out of it.
Yeah, I think that it's incredible the growing diversity of individuals looking to solve problems with fintech,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just figure out what's the next new venture, but how does that new venture really solve pain points for
right.
consumers?
Whether for a profit motive or just to the greater good.
But, you know, all of the incentives aren't necessarily aligned in that direction
Agreed.
Yet. And so our hope is that by tapping into those mission-driven fintechs that are trying to look at the specific challenges of low and moderate income households, we can do more to kind of focus energy in solving those problems. So what Aspen has done really in the background in many ways has created a space for a set of mission-driven fintechs to begin to meet with each other. This is the Nonprofit Leaders in Fintech and Nonprofit Leaders in Financial Technology Group.
It is specifically nonprofits.
Right now, it's specifically nonprofits. And the nice thing is each one of these has either product in market or is using a technology platform to organize information for their members. The few of those additional groups have come in. They're all still nonprofits, but in this broader umbrella of a consumer insights collaborative,
mm-hmm.
we started to look at collectively from a data asset that serves almost 500,000 people a year.
That's becoming a pretty meaningful sample.
Specifically in this low and moderate income market segment, what does this group know that can help inform the direction of additional innovation? So the first thing that they did together was say, what do we know about what drives short-term financial stability for households? We know that with rising income volatility, with issues with wages and expense shocks, that this predictability of income is a big deal.
We've seen a lot about the statistic about $400 surprise expenses, emergencies, and
so
strong percentage of households.
So the whole point here was with these very different but shared goal data sets, you know, what do these groups know together
mm-hmm.
from their families?
That they wouldn't necessarily know individually because everybody goes at it slightly differently, has a slightly different cut of the data.
Yeah. So at a high level aggregation, these nine organizations have a lot to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the four, you know, the cut to the point answer is there's really four things that seem to matter for these households. The first and most important is consistent positive cash flow. The second is a financial cushion.
The $400.
The $400.
There you go.
The third is access to credit, quality, affordable credit.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth is social networks. So there's two things.
How do you define social network?
They talked about their who would they go to? What are the ways that when people are dealing with challenges in terms of short-term stability, how does their broader social network chip in with that?
Advice, support, actual cash,
all of the above. And we have specific examples. The great thing about this report is we have crowdsourced in specific examples from the households that are representative of this data set around each of these things. None of those individual aspects is mind-blowing. The reality, though, is that the robustness of the data that underlines those four strategies across households across the country was pretty exciting. And it means that there's also a lot of new work to be done there. So consistent positive cash flow doesn't just mean you have a steady job. There's all these different ways that you can create consistent positive cash flow for
a
household.
Just discussing, I mean, especially in today's world with an increase in the gig economy, I mean, it's one thing if you have a regular biweekly paycheck or a monthly paycheck or whatever, but if it bounces all over, even if you do have a regular paycheck, but you have a different level of hours all the time,
you just
don't know exactly what it's going to look like at any given point.
Yeah, so there's a lot of examples in
about how these particular programs are already serving the needs of helping people smooth their income, but also how other partners are coming into that mix as well. So we put a spotlight on their work, on the leadership of these organizations. So it's groups like EARN and the Financial Clinic and Neighborhood Trust. I won't mention all of them, but...
But they all have products in market.
They all have product in market. A couple of the groups like the Family Independence Initiative and LIFT Communities don't serve their own product into the market, either financial advice or financial product. But what they do is connect people to the right kinds of products. Or in the case of a group like Commonwealth, they are really helping to innovate with large companies around the country to also solve these pain points. So
I think we've managed to get five of the companies in there.
I know,
five
I do
six,
a lot of it. So, yeah. I think the main thing is this group is going to continue to work together, and they're inviting a broader set of companies to start looking at their own data and thinking about data for good. I think that one of the things that came out of the session you and I did today was understanding that financial innovation and financial technology, it's not going to accidentally solve financial inclusion problems. There's going to have to be a lot of intentional targeting of the opportunities and potential of technology to solve these real problems. And so groups like the ones that we're trying to convene, conferences like this one are places where we're really trying to create a supply and demand intersection so that the kinds of ways that we can harness innovation to solve for financial challenges becomes front and center for a lot more leaders.
And this is something you're putting out. You've got a couple reports you've already published from this data. And then you're also attempting to, I mean, the convening mechanism. Is it beyond the group of nine?
Yeah,
The
group of nine meets regularly. Then we invite in a broader set of for-profit and government agencies, all of whom have large data sets themselves, to look at what this group is learning and to look for themselves at what they can do to take on more. And the list of topics that we might look at are growing as well. So there was a lot of conversation here today about going cashless and, you know, the pros of that, but also the cons of that.
What's interesting, because we're seeing the backlash on that.
Yeah, so we don't, so, you know, why don't we stop and ask?
Yeah.
What are the implications of this? So there's, you know, issues around that. These issues of, you know, beyond liquidity, you know, one of the things that didn't come up in this first report was anything about insurance, because honestly, most of the households that we're talking with don't have access.
Yeah, this is not at this point Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
So they don't self-recognize that as a solution, but we know that innovation in the insurance space could be one of the big things. Once you start to see every single household trying to insure themselves against risks over $500, I think that calls for a different kind of financial product than a savings account. I think that starts to talk about innovation in public and private insurance, you know, and that's another opportunity.
And again, your goal here is to really shine a light on this so that new people looking for new ways to innovate can solve these pain points. Is that part of your goal?
Yeah, I think for Aspen, the heart of a strong economy and a strong democracy, strong household balance sheets, you know, families and stability at the household level underpins all sorts of other kinds of resilience in the economy.
But there's nothing proprietary here. You're looking to share this information.
We want to share this information. We want data to be used for good. Aspen is really all about the good society and inviting leaders to use whatever sources of influence and power they can to solve the problems that we are all here to do something about.
Great. And if people want to find out more, and these reports, I believe, are posted online, what's
they're
the best way
online
to track them down?
Yeah, we're on Twitter, but our website is aspenfsp.org.
And FSP as in Financial Security Program.
FSP. And we've been publishing 2-3 reports a month.
That's .org.
That's right.
Ida Rademacher, Financial Security Program, from the Aspen Institute. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Glenn.
So thanks again to all of our panelists for taking the time to talk. Ida Rademacher of the Aspen Institute, Marielle Beasley of the Common Sense Lab, and President of Operation Hope, Anita Ward. I've yammered on long enough again for another week. My name is Glenn Sarvati of 154 Advisors. You can find me on Twitter at 154 Advisors, or contact me via the Best Innovation Group website, big-fintech.com. You can find our grand poobah, John Best, on Twitter as well, at JB Fintech. And as I mentioned before, you'll be hearing from us next week directly from AXFI. If you're interested in particularly this financial inclusion and financial wellness topic, and you haven't checked it out already, last week's episode was related to interviews that I did at the Financial Health Networks Conference, Emerge. that took place just a couple weeks earlier. We'll post a link to that one too, so you can check that out. Please do check back every Tuesday for new content here on the Big Pass. Big Cast. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, thanks very much for listening.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech, email us at info@big-fintech.com, or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.